Good day, everyone, and thank you for joining our expert call series hosted by Roth Capital Partners. Today's conference is being recorded. At this time, I'd like to turn the conference over to Dr. Yasmeen Rahimi. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Anna, and thank you, everyone, for joining our part one out of a three-part call series that I'm hosting with for Immunic. Today's call is focused to get a deeper understanding of IMU-838, Immunic lead asset for the treatment of COVID-19. It's absolutely an honor and a privilege to have with us Dr. Miles Mills. He's a professor of surgery at the University of Chicago School of Medicine. I do want to say thank you on behalf of all of our listeners, as well as the team here at Roth, for all the work that you are doing currently against the fight of COVID and being at the front line. And thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule to be with us. So words can't really describe how happy we are to have you with us. With that also said, I want to remind everybody that's listening to the call that if they have any questions, please email me at yrahimi@roth.com, and I'll make sure to ask them of Dr. Miles. With that said, Dr. Miles, if you could share with us any conflicts of interest that you may have, that would be great, and then we'll jump right into a number of questions and topics that we have already prepared.
Yeah, so just say I do not have any conflict of interest with any company that is currently trying to develop DHODH inhibition for any indication.
Thank you, Dr. Miles. Dr. Miles, can you maybe tell us a little bit about your background and currently the work that you're doing in COVID-19? And then what are key lessons that we have learned in the last few weeks about the virus? And then we have a lot of very specific questions for you.
Sure. So I got interested in DHODH inhibition through transplant route. Since I am a transplant surgeon, I've been in practice for over 25 years. I have been at the University of Chicago for that same amount of time. I finished my fellowship at UCLA in 1994 and came to the University of Chicago and have been there ever since doing clinical liver transplantation, administration, clinical research, some basic research, policy work, et cetera. I was head of transplant for 17 years before stepping down a couple of years ago to work on some other activities. And I'll skip the story of how I ultimately first became interested in DHODH inhibitors, although it's a particularly interesting personal story. But certainly, DHODH inhibition first kind of started in the transplant route with Breclinar, which was being developed by, maybe Merck or somebody, in solid tumors. And they also had some trials in transplant. And then the solid tumor trials didn't work out, so they stopped the development, and therefore Breclinar was no longer accessible for transplant trials. But then ultimately leflunomide came around and allowed another drug to look at DHODH inhibition in transplant patients. And it's particularly interesting in the transplant realm in that we deal with viral diseases as well as the immunosuppression side. And our group helped define the immunosuppressive as well as antiviral activities of DHODH inhibition. And so when COVID started its march around the world, I asked the question whether DHODH inhibition could help treat this disease. And so, as I mentioned, I've done policy work. A lot of that policy work has been in China. And so I sent out a question to some of my friends in China who I knew had done some work with DHODH inhibition and asked them if there had been any data about DHODH inhibition and SARS-CoV-2. And the responses that I got were very encouraging, that yes, there had been both in vitro and some clinical data demonstrating efficacy in treating and inhibiting viral replication in SARS-CoV-2. So that got me started on the path of DHODH inhibition, and then I saw Immunex press release, and through I knew the chairman of the board through a previous company that we had worked with, and so I contacted him and started to understand more about Immunex DHODH inhibitor. So that's kind of how I got here. So I now have a trial that is recruiting just to ensure that DHODH inhibitors are well tolerated in patients with SARS-CoV-2. And that's, as one would expect, just a repurposed drug of the current commercially available DHODH inhibitor, one of the two, leflunomide. And so we are enrolling and have enrolled in that trial, and we are looking to move that on to a randomized controlled trial alone and in combination with some other antiviral aspects.
Thank you, Dr. Miles, for the insightful color you provided with us. Can you share with our audience why DHODH makes mechanistic sense for the treatment of COVID? Specifically, what do you see as the relevant mechanisms targeting the virus-infected host cells for COVID-19 therapy?
Most of the specific antiviral therapies work on different aspects of the viral mechanisms of action. And the difference with DHODH inhibitors and IMU-838 is that this works on the host side. And all cells need, at some level, nucleotides, purines, and pyrimidines. And when a cell is infected by virus, and could be many viruses, but in this scenario we're talking about SARS-CoV-2, that one of the signals that the virus does is to try to make the cell increase its nucleotide synthesis through the de novo pathway. And they do this because they need a lot of nucleotides in order to replicate themselves and then go out and infect other cells. And so if you look at the structure of SARS-CoV-2, you have about 30,000 nucleotides, of which about 15,000 are pyrimidines, and we're talking about pyrimidines because DHODH inhibits the pyrimidine synthesis. And with coronaviruses in general, they can, per cell, try to produce anywhere from 20 to 8,000 viral particles per infected cell. We don't exactly know where in that spectrum SARS-CoV-2 lands, but given the fairly rapid viral acceleration of disease, it's probably in the, you know, let's say 5,000 viral particles per cell. And so if we assume that, then pyrimidine, that you know, each cell would need 75 million pyrimidines in order to generate the viral particles that it wants to help infect the cells next door and other cells. And so that stresses the cell and makes the DHODH enzyme, which is the rate-limiting step for pyrimidine synthesis, critical. And if you can inhibit that step, then you're inhibiting the development of pyrimidines in the host cell and therefore inhibiting the viral replication just because the virus doesn't have enough nucleotides to make its RNA moving on to the next cells. So that's why it makes sense to utilize this. The other aspect is we know, so that's one mechanism of action. Another mechanism of action is that we know that SARS-CoV-2 really enhances the immune response, and that's the cytokine storm. And all of that cytokine storm requires activated lymphocytes and B cells, et cetera. And every activated lymphocyte, et cetera, needs those pyrimidines once again to generate all that, all those activities and all those cytokines. And so, by having a drug, IMU-838 or DHODH inhibition, then you are also decreasing the development of that cytokine storm in that whole process of the disease. So we feel that it would be effective early as well as up to the, you know, early aspects of the cytokine storm through the inhibition of DHODH.
Thank you, Dr. Mouse. Could you, so with that said, maybe what would be helpful is to kind of contrast it with other antiviral agents who may just, the time of intervention might be critical of an importance. So could you comment on sort of the different stages on COVID-19 from clinical signs, specifically in regards to the mechanisms of the pathways that are turned on? That could be very helpful as we think about it and where intervention of other modalities of direct antivirals or immunomodulators come in could be helpful, just to contrast it versus DHODH.
Yeah, so it's a kind of a difficult question to answer, not because we don't have a number of different agents. It's just that we don't know where they all would fit in. For instance, there's recent reports that interferon beta can be effective. There's also countering articles that say that it didn't work. So if you look at that, those two articles, one from Spain, it didn't work, one from Hong Kong, saying it did work. Hong Kong treated much earlier than the Spanish group, and it would make sense that, from what we can understand about SARS-CoV-2 and its activities, it actually seems to downregulate the production of beta interferon. And why would it do that? Well, beta interferon, one of its actions is to generate antiviral gene sequences. And by down-regulating the beta interferon, it actually allows more cells to be susceptible to viral infection. Other aspects of the virus still stimulates the cytokines. And so what seems to be happening is that the virus is down-regulating interferon early, to allow more cells to be susceptible to viral infection, and so then they keep making viruses, viral particles, because it's unchecked by anything else. And it still allows for the cytokines to be formed, and then that's what ultimately provides the cytokine storm. So we think that early beta interferon would be helpful in helping to decrease the susceptibility of cells to the viral infection. And then, but certainly late, it would probably just be adding fuel to a fire, i.e. the cytokine storm, that you don't want. So a lot of it is going to be timing, whereas with beta interferon, whereas with DHODH inhibitors, it seems because of what we believe would be the mechanism of effectiveness in this disease, it would be effective for both early as well as at least mid kind of viral disease aspects. The IL-6 inhibitors that are in trial as well are likely to be more effective in the later stages rather than the earlier stages, and so it's probably not going to be a big factor in the early modification of disease. The remdesivir could be effective both early and late. We certainly have seen it, as we all know from all the publicities of their trials, that it has effectiveness. It is not a silver bullet. It's not as effective as we would kind of ultimately hope for. I think the analogy would be it's kind of like AZT in the early stages of trying to deal with the HIV/AIDS epidemic. For those of you who are old enough to remember the AZT days of that aspect, in which we all applauded that at least we had a drug that could help modulate that disease, but it certainly wasn't a panacea, and as we all know, subsequent more direct acting antivirals were developed for AIDS, HIV AIDS. So I think we'll see that evolution in this disease as well. Remdesivir is good. We have a bullet. That doesn't mean we have a machine gun, but we have a bullet. That bullet is reasonably sized, but it's not a cannon sized bullet. So we still need many other bullets and more effective bullets that will probably target in any number of different pathways. But I think this, IMU 838, DHODH inhibitors in general, would be a baseline antiviral for many viruses. We know that it works in a number of viruses already, BK, polyomavirus, CMV, et cetera. So we know that it does have antiviral activities, and we believe that it would have antiviral activities against SARS-CoV-2 in humans. And it likely would be effective in any future viral disease that has a high replication rate.
Thank you for the color. Are there any disadvantages of targeting DHODH for COVID-19? Are there certain patients, populations that may not be benefiting from it? Are there lessons that we've learned from its antiviral activity against other pathogenic viruses?
Yes. So the currently approved DHODH inhibitors have two black box warnings. And just so that everybody understands, leflunomide is a prodrug of teriflunomide. Both are approved. The prodrug and the active metabolite are approved. Leflunomide for rheumatoid arthritis, teriflunomide for multiple sclerosis. in vivo, in the human body, they're essentially the same drug, because leflunomide is metabolized by the liver into its active metabolite teriflunomide on a first pass basis. They both have very long half lives, up to like 14, 15 days. The information that we have in regards to what concerns we might have are largely based on the experience of those two drugs. And as I mentioned, they are FDA approved, so in general they are safe, but the black box warnings are pregnancy, which likely every DHODH inhibitor will have that, because of the inhibition of pyrimidines is necessary for pregnancies, et cetera. And then liver disease. And so currently one of the exclusion criteria in the clinical trial that I have running is a known history of liver disease. So those are the two black box warnings. What we also know about chronic DHODH inhibitors is that it can produce a leukopenia, so a decreased white blood cell count, once again because of the known mechanism of action. The great thing about that is that that's usually seen in chronic administration, and we see this medication more for viral diseases, as a viral diseases such as SARS-CoV-2, as a 2-week type of intervention. 10 days probably would be sufficient, and it is very unlikely to have significant leukopenia associated with DHODH inhibition in that relatively short period of time, especially if, as IMU-838 has, a much shorter half-life in the range of 40 hours versus 14 days, you don't have the ongoing effects of the DHODH inhibition that could continue to produce some leukopenia. Now, most of these patients with SARS-CoV-2 do have a level of, especially the severe ones, of leukopenia, and that's fairly typical of severe viral illnesses. But that's not necessarily going to be exacerbated by a relatively short course of DHODH inhibition. So those are the what we know about it. The IMU-838, the clinical results so far of their studies, treating over 500 patients, is that the safety profile it looks to be much better than the currently approved DHODH inhibitors. And so that would make it even better in terms of a antiviral agent to use in a broad spectrum of patients and a broad swath of the population that may be infected or have been exposed to patients with SARS-CoV.
Thank you for the color. And are you aware of any other molecules that are currently in development for the treatment of COVID-19 that inhibits both viral replication plus has a selective immunomodulatory effect, such as IMU-838?
So since I registered my trial, obviously, on clinicaltrials.gov, I have been contacted by a number of companies, both private and public companies, large and small, who are interested in developing DHODH inhibitors that were in various levels of development, either preclinical or clinical development. So I am knowledgeable about some of those efforts, but just as I have with Immunec, I have signed confidentiality agreements with those, and so can't really say much more than that. I don't know of any other class of drug that is being developed that would have the same antiviral effect as well as the anti-inflammatory immune modulator aspect that DHODH inhibition seems to be able to provide.
Thank you, Dr. Mills. Before we get to discuss the in vitro data, can you maybe educate our investors about what are the current widely or accepted or validated in vitro assays for testing the activity against SARS-CoV-2?
Yeah, so it's a good question. There's not a good answer. The in vitro data ranges anything from people are using any type of similar coronavirus, and so that can be influenza A and B, it can be a mouse hepatitis. What we are doing at the University of Chicago is using those models to test agents, and then those that demonstrate promise either independently or in combination are then moved on to our biosafety lab, level 3 lab out at Argonne to do other tests, and they are developing hopefully a murine model of that is transfected with a human ACE2 receptor to help utilize that model as to determine how effective it is in a small animal model. So typically the cells that are being used are Vero cells or any number of other cells that have a high ACE2 receptor concentration and then spiked with whatever virus. If it's in a level 3 biocontainment lab, then you can utilize those cellular constructs and actually utilize SARS-CoV-2 in those experiments. If they are not, if you're not, then you do it in a non-SARS-CoV-2 but similar coronavirus lab setup, and then demonstrate a curve of a dose response curve that would demonstrate the ability to inhibit or kill virally infected cells.
Thank you, Dr. Mao. Can you maybe, as you know, IMU-838 has demonstrated inhibition of SARS-CoV-2 replication in 3 separate in vitro models in human lung epithelial cells, in monkey kidney cells, and also in the Vero E4 cells, monkey kidney cells. And I understand it's very difficult to compare IC90s versus against other agents that are in development, especially if they weren't concurrently run in the assay. But can you just maybe share with us your impression of the data that you've seen so far for IMU-838? That would be very helpful for us.
Sure. The data out of Utah State, I think, was very convincing that that IMU-838 is effective in their models of SARS-CoV-2 in vitro, and it is similar to other data that I've seen for other DHODH inhibitors, but like I say, the IMU-838 has certain pharmacokinetic advantages and safety profile advantages that I think make it particularly attractive in potentially utilizing in a number of different aspects of patients that are infected with COVID. So the in vitro data is pretty convincing, and it's convincing in and of itself, but it's also supportive of a broader fund of knowledge of GH-ODH inhibitors having effect on SARS-CoV-2.
Thank you. That's helpful. Another question we have for you is if you could share with us, what is the transferability of this in vitro data to humans? And what specific data point offers the best read-through from preclinical data to clinical antiviral effects?
Yeah, so I think that we have good evidence that it would be translatable from a preclinical model to a clinical model. And I base that primarily on the fact that we have many years of evidence that DHODH inhibitors are safe in humans, and that the Immunix data for INU-838 shows that it is, in fact, has a better safety profile. So the first thing you have to consider when you're thinking about moving from a preclinical model to a clinical model is, would it be safe in humans? And so we can, once again, understand that DHODH inhibition has been used for many, many years, and it has been shown to be safe. And the data from IMU-838 appears to show that it's got an even better safety profile, which is important when you're thinking about a broad administration of this drug to many people. So that's the first step in translating preclinical data to humans, and then you can start thinking about, well, you know, would it be effective? Well, and how would we measure that effectiveness? That's a much harder aspect to get specific on at this point in time. What we are likely going to utilize is a clinical symptom scorecard that I have developed that our first trial is essentially validating, and so that we can tweak it to make sure that it's capturing what we want to do. And so an accelerated improvement of a clinical scorecard, because we have to remember that the vast majority of patients that we see, say, in the emergency room, even if they have the risk factors of getting more severe disease, will clear their disease without any intervention. So what we have to do to demonstrate effectiveness is to demonstrate, I think, one of a couple of things. One would be improvement in the rate of their clinical symptomatology resolving. Two, improve the rate of viral clearance, and potentially a cytokine marker of reducing IL-6 throughout their stage of disease. The first two are likely going to be far more clinically relevant. The third, the IL-6, is more of would be supporting data that it has the ability to inhibit the cytokine storm aspect of the the mechanism, presumed mechanism of action. So the first two, especially the viral clearance, the improving viral clearance, would be the antiviral aspect of the mechanism of action, and then the IL-6 reduction would be associated with the immunomodulating aspect of the drug. So when you're trying to think of efficacy and you think of these two primarily modes of action for DH inhibitors, I think you need to try to have some primary endpoints that would focus on both of them. And so the viral clearance and the clinical symptomology for one and the IL-6 reduction in the other.
Dr. Mills, you mentioned you're developing the clinical scorecard. How different is this clinical scorecard versus the HLA ordinal scale for clinical status?
Yeah, so the WHO's thing is a really rather general aspects of being able to kind of put a number on clinical diseases that we clinical disease that we see. The scorecard that I have developed is much more specific in terms of the symptoms that that patients typically have, and it runs everything from temperature, you know, whether they're having a temperature of greater than 100.4 several times a day to no temperature for greater than 72 hours, you know, the lack of taste or smell, malaise from, you know, you don't want to get out of bed to feeling normal. You've got, you know, all of these symptoms I have listed on my scorecard. I already mentioned the fever and the malaise or the fatigue, dry cough, sore throat, nasal congestion, myalgias, arthralgias, headaches and photophobia, sense of taste, sense of smell, shortness of breath, and GI symptoms. So if we look at the symptoms that our patients have, that list will capture almost all of it, and each of them is on a scale of 1 to 5 in terms of their symptomatology, and it appears to be a pretty good scorecard for these patients and their improvement in their symptomatology. Whereas the WHO is just, it's a very general or gross concept of the symptomatology that the patients have. I mean, they're using 8 or something points to go from essentially normal to dead, whereas I have 5 points in each of those 11 categories.
Thank you for the granular color, Dr. Miles. Is this clinical scale card being utilized in other studies besides Immunix COVID-1 study?
I'm sorry, what's the question?
Are there any clinical studies using your clinical scorecard yet?
Yes, so the trial that I'm doing right now, which is a trial just looking at the tolerability of DHODH inhibitors in patients with high-risk COVID-19, it is being used in that trial, and we are likely going to be rolling that same scorecard out into other investigator-initiated trials at the University of Chicago.
Okay, wonderful. And then maybe what would be helpful for our listeners is, IMU-838, the patient population for the study is going to be the moderate disease patients. So can you maybe tell us why the selection of this group could make sense to start off with? We did speak a great deal about its broad antiviral activity, but if you could give us a little bit more color of fine-tuning why that patient population was selected, could be helpful for us.
Yeah, so I think that as long as you're not going to be treating patients in the severe category, that the treatment with IMU-838 is reasonable. The reason not to do the severe patients is, number one, severe patients have lots of complications, many of which are not necessarily associated with the drug. And when you're trying to prove safety and efficacy, it's really hard to get there when you're treating patients in the severe category. Second is that it probably takes, well, first of all, it's likely going to be more effective in the earlier stages of the disease when viral replication is really cranked up, so that you can stop the viral replication. Then, secondly, it's even with a shorter half-life and therefore a ability to get a therapeutic level more quickly and at steady state, it's still going to take some time to get good inhibition. So it's not like monoclonal antibody, which like for the IL-6 antibodies, that you give it and it has an immediate effect on the levels of IL-6. You give this drug and it's going to take some time for it to actually start inhibiting and start depriving the cell and the virus of the nucleotides that it needs. So it's not going to be like a IL-6 blocker or potentially even an interferon beta therapy, which if you give early, you will immediately increase your level of interferon and hopefully stimulate those viral inhibition genes. So I think that's you have to get in that period in which there's a lot of viral replication activity and starve that cell of the pyrimidines, and that's going to take a little bit of time, and not the minutes to hours that the monoclonal antibodies and other things might provide.
Thank you for the color. Another question we have for you is that in UX phase 2 study is treatment or placebo arm on top of the investigator's choice of standard of care therapy. Are there different options for standard of care? You could just elaborate on what the different choices are that different investigators could be offering, and how that could be contributing.
Yeah, so the standard of care is rapidly evolving for COVID-19. As we all know, if you'd asked that 3 weeks ago, remdesivir would be considered experimental, and now even though it's not approved and it's got emergency use approval, but it's not fully FDA approved, most people would say that's the standard of care for hospitalized patients. But that may absolutely change, next week. What we know of today is that remdesivir in a randomized trial, 5 days is as good as 10 days. But certainly some patients will utilize 10 days worth of drug, whereas others will be significantly better after a couple of doses. So the standard of care, it would be impossible, I think, right now to write a clinical protocol that would proscribe the standard of care and expect that standard of care to last anything more than a month or two in really today's rapidly changing environment. So I think if you're writing a protocol, right now you have to say, standard of care plus something. It's interesting. Most patients we have found that describe in a clinical trial, they don't necessarily want a placebo arm. So if you were just going to say no standard of care, you're just going to have supportive care, Tylenol, things like that, plus IMU-838, or nothing. And then the third option is, the ability of the hospital to use their standard of care, which would be remdesivir, et cetera. You're not going to get enrollment in that trial because patients are going to want something therapeutic other than just symptomatic relief.
And are there big differences between the standard care options in the U.S. and Europe?
I would say that there's differences in the standard of care. I'm not sure that any of those differences impact outcomes. China kind of mandated a certain regimen as standard of care. I'm not sure what, let's say, the European countries are doing, whether their ministries of health are mandating certain levels of care. Many health systems are more centralized in the assignment of therapies for any number of diseases. The U.S. has never been that way. We are a much more heterogeneous medical system and much more freedom allowing in terms of individual's doctor and their relationship with that patient. And so we in general do not mandate standards of care for any disease in the U.S. and certainly in other countries they do, but I don't know if other, say, European countries have mandated certain therapies.
Thank you. And then, as you know, the primary endpoint of Immunix study is the proportion of patients without any need of invasive ventilation. Can you share with us, what we know so far from data sets that we have seen, what the range of response would be in the placebo arm and what we have seen for duration of treatment and 28-day all-cause mortality?
That data is not well established in the U.S. or in Western countries in general. The data that I've seen is that, 85% of patients with COVID will resolve their disease without hospitalization. About 15% of patients will require hospitalization, and somewhere around 5% will require an intensive care unit and significant ventilatory assistance, whether that's intubation or other relatively invasive respiratory therapy such as high pressure CPAP or the helmets and things like that. I think we see in that it's rapidly changing that as well. I mean, in our experience at the University of Chicago, in which we treated almost 200 patients with remdesivir in their severe arm, we saw good results in our rate of ventilatory of having to intubate patients. I would say seems to be much less than the generally reported results. So a lot of it also depends on the ICU management in any particular hospital.
Thank you, Dr. Reynolds. Another question for us is, which biomarkers, besides looking at SARS-CoV-2 viral load or IgA or IgE antibodies, are of high importance for judging, disease activity in COVID-19 or response to IMU-838?
Well, I think I've answered that question earlier, in that the things that you've mentioned are viral loads and how rapidly they decline or decrease the peak levels, the symptoms, which is not a biomarker, obviously, but and then the seemingly what is currently the primary cytokine that people are following is IL-6. We do have a study by the guy who runs the human immunology core at the University of Chicago, who has accumulated samples on all of the hospitalized COVID patients and is running cytokine assays on them. We don't have the results back yet on that, but that may help us define additional cytokines or biomarkers. The development of antibodies right now is such a unknown science, I would guess it right now, in terms of the antibody test that is being used, how specific that is to neutralizing type antibodies, et cetera. Yes, people seem to develop antibodies, and some people develop high titers of what appear to be neutralizing antibodies, and others don't. And that's why you get so much conflicting information from organizations like the CDC or the WHO, et cetera, about what the impact of those antibodies is into how we get back to our normal life.
Thank you. And another question we have, obviously, with numerous COVID trials ongoing, how do sponsors sort of, select patients for their studies, and specifically as you're looking at patients that you're treating, how do you determine who should be on 838 as more studies are coming online?
Yeah, it's a difficult aspect, and it's also difficult in that clearly in most cities we are seeing a dramatic reduction in patients presenting with COVID-19. We are, the University of Chicago, I think, is down in the 60s now in terms of the number of hospitalized patients, and have been at that level for the last couple of days. At our peak, we were almost at 200, and I think that is relatively representative of most hospitals around the country. So you're having a decreased number of patients at the same time with more interest and more studies getting ramped up. So it's going to be, a challenge for especially the, academic medical centers like the one I'm at, the University of Chicago, where we have, we probably right now have more ideas than we have, hospitalized patients in terms of how to treat COVID-19 patients. So it's going to take the interest of an investigator and the support of a sponsor to, I think, get studies going. And it's going to have scientific validity in order to get the academic medical centers really to buy in.
Thank you. That's very helpful. Do you envision as many states have sort of reduced social restriction measures and open up parts of the country that maybe those hospitalizations are going to then actually start inclining, because hospitalization and death as sort of a delayed response. So maybe those could be coming back up as we head into July and August.
Well, it's certainly a possibility. Obviously, that's not our hope from a public health perspective, but it's certainly a possibility, and I would say in many ways likely. It is, to me, much more likely that starting, you know, November-ish, we will see a quite an increase in cases. Once again, starting, you know, in the northern big cities and then moving around the country, just because the, you know, that's when coronaviruses usually start taking off, is in that November timeframe. So I think that many of us are just kind of saying, okay, well, we'll get our protocols set, and if we enroll some over the next couple of months, that's great. But we will be ready with all types of protocols for the fall and winter season and the next year to really get enrollment rolling, because I think that it, you know, we've kind of gone over the peak right now in the U.S., thank goodness. If, you know, probably if you can organize trials right now in Russia or in South America, then you, you know, probably have a good number of patients to enroll soon. But, you know, those are, you know, present all kinds of different challenges. You know, it's the number of patients clearly is going down right now, and that's okay from a public health perspective, not so good from a clinical trials perspective.
Thank you so much, Dr. Mao. We're coming to the end of our call, and I want to say thank you to you on behalf of all of our listeners for your insightful comments that you provided, and of course, the work that you're doing on the front line. So we're really appreciative on many fronts, and thank you again for being with us during this your crazy schedule. And I am also required, given that we spoke on this call about Immunique, that to share the disclosures, which are within the last 12 months, Roth has received compensation for investment banking services for Immunique. Roth makes marketing shares of Immunique and has such buys and sells from customers on a principal basis. With that behind, thank you again for a wonderful hour.
So, and so with that, I would just also say that I was compensated for this hour of time taken out of my day.
Thank you. Thank you for sharing that as well.
Yep.
And have a wonderful weekend.
Okay, thank you. You too.
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
And that concludes today's conference. Thank you for your participation. You may now disconnect.